she said. You're crazy, said Cal. Aaron will knock that out of you. Do you think he will? Well, sure, said Cal. He's got to.
This ends Disc 18. East of Eden, Disc 19.
Chapter 45. Joe Valery got along by watching and listening, and, as he said himself, not sticking his neck out. He had built his hatreds little by little, beginning with a mother who neglected him, a father who alternately whipped and slobbered over him. And it had been easy to transfer his developing hatred to the teacher who disciplined him, and the policeman who chased him, and the priest who lectured him. Even before the first magistrate looked down on him, Joe had developed a fine stable of hates toward the whole world he knew. Hate can't live alone. It must have love as a trigger, a goad, or a stimulant. Joe early developed a gentle, protective love for Joe. He comforted and flattered and cherished Joe. He set up walls to save Joe from a hostile world. And gradually, Joe became proof against wrong. If Joe got into trouble, it was because the world was in angry conspiracy against him. And if Joe attacked the world, it was revenge, and they damn well deserved it, the sons of bitches. Joe lavished every care on his love, and he perfected a lonely set of rules, which might have gone like this. 1, don't believe nobody. The bastards are after you. 2, keep your mouth shut. Don't stick your neck out. 3, keep your ears open. When they make a slip, grab onto it and wait. 4, everybody's a son of a bitch, and whatever you do, they got it coming. 5, go at everything roundabout. 6, don't never trust no dame about nothing. 7, put your faith in dough. Everybody wants it. Everybody will sell out for it. There were other rules, but they were refinements. His system worked, and since he knew no other, Joe had no basis of comparison with other systems. He knew it was necessary to be smart, and he considered himself smart. If he pulled something off, that was smart. If he failed, that was bad luck. Joe wasn't very successful, but he got by, and with a minimum of effort. Kate kept him because she knew he would do anything in the world if he were paid to do it or was afraid not to do it. She had no illusions about him. In her business, Joes were necessary. When he first got the job with Kate, Joe looked for the weakness on which he lived. Vanity, voluptuousness, anxiety, or conscience, greed, hysteria. He knew they were there because she was a woman. It was a matter of considerable shock to him to learn that if they were there, he couldn't find them. This dame thought and acted like a man, only tougher, quicker, and more clever. Joe made a few mistakes, and Kate rubbed his nose in them. He developed an admiration for her, based on fear. When he found that he couldn't get away with some things, he began to believe he couldn't get away with anything. Kate made a slave of him just as he had always made slaves of women. She fed him, clothed him, gave him orders, punished him. Once Joe recognized her as more clever than himself, it was a short step to the belief that she was more clever than anybody. He thought that she possessed the two great gifts. She was smart, and she got the breaks. And you couldn't want no better than that. He was glad to do her hatchet work, and afraid not to. Kate don't make no mistakes, Joe said, and if you played along with her, Kate took care of you. This went beyond thought and became a habit pattern. When he got Ethel floated over the county line, it was all in a day's work. It was Kate's business, and she was smart. Kate didn't sleep well when the arthritic pains were bad. She could almost feel her joints thicken and knot. Sometimes she tried to think of other things, even unpleasant ones, to drive the pain and the distorted fingers from her mind. Sometimes she tried to remember every detail in a room she hadn't seen for a long time. Sometimes she looked at the ceiling and projected columns of figures and added them. Sometimes she used memories. She built Mr. Edwards' face and his clothes and the word that was stamped on the metal clasp of his suspenders. She had never noticed it, but she knew the word was Excelsior. Often in the night she thought of Faye, remembered her eyes and hair and the tone of her voice and how her hands fluttered, and the little lump of flesh beside her left thumbnail, a scar from an ancient cut. Kate went into her feeling about Faye. Did she hate or love her? Did she pity her? Was she sorry she had killed her? Kate inched over her own thoughts like a measuring worm. She found she had no feeling about Faye. She neither liked nor disliked her, or her memory. There had been a time during her dying when the noise and the smell of her had made anger rise in Kate so that she considered killing her quickly to get it over. Kate remembered how Faye had looked the last time she saw her, lying in her purple casket, dressed in white, with the undertaker's smile on her lips and enough powder and rouge to cover her sallow skin. A voice behind Kate had said, "She looks better than she has in years." And another voice had answered, "Maybe the same thing would do me some good." And there was a double snicker. The first voice would be Ethel, and the second, Trixie. Kate remembered her own half-humorous reaction. "Why," she had thought, "a dead whore looks like anybody else." Yes, the first voice must have been Ethel. Ethel always got into the night thinking, and Ethel always brought a shrinking fear with her. The stupid, clumsy, nosy bitch. The lousy old bag. And it happened very often that Kate's mind would tell her, "Now wait a minute. Why is she a lousy old bag? Isn't it because you made a mistake? Why did you float her? If you'd used your head and kept her here..." Kate wondered where Ethel was. How about one of those agencies to find Ethel? At least to find where she went? Yes. And then Ethel would tell about that night and show the glass. Then there'd be two noses sniffing instead of one. Yes, but what difference would that make? Every time Ethel got a beer in her, she would be telling somebody. Oh, sure, but they would think she was just a buzzed old hustler. Now, an agency man. No agencies. Kate spent many hours with Ethel. Did the judge have any idea it was a frame? Too simple? It shouldn't have been an even $100. That was obvious. And how about the sheriff? Joe said they'd dropped her over the line into Santa Cruz County. What did Ethel tell the deputy who drove her out? Ethel was a lazy old bat. Maybe she had stayed in Watsonville. There was Pajaro, and that was a railroad section. And then the Pajaro River and the bridge into Watsonville. Lots of section hands went back and forth. Mexicans, some Hindus. That puddlehead Ethel might have thought she could turn enough tricks with the track workers. Wouldn't it be funny if she had never left Watsonville, 30 miles away? She could even slip in over the line and see her friends if she wanted to. Maybe she came to Salinas sometimes. She might be in Salinas right now. The cops weren't likely to keep too much on the look for her. Maybe it'd be a good idea to send Joe over to Watsonville to see if Ethel was there. She might have gone on to Santa Cruz. Joe could look there, too. It wouldn't take him long. Joe could find any hooker in any town in a few hours. If he found her, they could get her back somehow. Ethel was a fool. But maybe when he found her, it would be better if Kate went to her. Lock the door. Leave a do not disturb sign. She could get to Watsonville, do her business, and get back. No taxis, take a bus. Nobody saw anybody on the night buses. People sleeping with their shoes off and coats rolled up behind their heads. Suddenly, she knew she would be afraid to go to Watsonville. Well, she could make herself go. It would stop all this wondering. Strange she hadn't thought of sending Joe before. That was perfect. Joe was good at some things, and the dumb bastard thought he was clever. That was the kind easiest to handle. Ethel was stupid. That made her hard to handle. As her hands and her mind grew more crooked, Kate began to rely more and more on Joe Valerie as her assistant-in-chief, as her go-between, and as her executioner. She had a basic fear of the girls in the house. Not that they were more untrustworthy than Joe, but that the hysteria which lay very close to the surface might at any time crack through their caution and shatter their sense of self-preservation and tear down not only themselves but their surroundings. Kate had always been able to handle this ever-present danger, but now the slow depositing calcium and the slow growth of apprehension caused her to need help and to look for it from Joe. Men, she knew, had a little stronger wall against self-destruction than the kind of women she knew. She felt that she could trust Joe, because she had in her files a notation relating to one Joseph Venuta, who had walked away from a San Quentin road gang in the fourth year of a 5-year sentence for robbery. Kate had never mentioned this to Joe Valerie, but she thought it might have a soothing influence on him if he got out of hand. Joe brought the breakfast tray every morning, green China tea and cream and toast. When he had set it on her bedside table, he made his report and got his orders for the day. He knew that she was depending on him more and more, and Joe was very slowly and quietly exploring the possibility of taking over entirely. If she got sick enough, there might be a chance, but very profoundly, Joe was afraid of her. "Morning," he said. "I'm not going to sit up for it, Joe. Just give me the tea. You'll have to hold it."
"Hands bad?"
"Yes. They get better after a flare-up."
"Looks like you had a bad night."
"No," said Kate. "I had a good night. I've got some new medicine."
Joe held the cup to her lips, and she drank the tea in little sips, breathing in over it to cool it.
"That's enough," she said, when the cup was only half empty. "How was the night?"
"I almost came to tell you last night," said Joe. "Hick came in from King City, just sold his crop, bought out the house, dropped 700, not counting what he'd give the girls."
"What was his name?"
"I don't know, but I hope he comes in again."
"You should get the name, Joe. I've told you that."
"He was cagey."
"All the more reason to get his name. Didn't any of the girls frisk him?"
"I don't know."
"Well, find out."
Joe sensed a mild geniality in her, and it made him feel good.
"I'll find out," he assured her. "I've got enough to go on."
Her eyes went over him, testing and searching, and he knew something was coming.
"You like it here?"
she asked softly.
"Sure. I got it good here."
"You could have it better. Or worse," she said.
"I like it good here,"
he said uneasily, and his mind cast about for a fault in himself.
"I got it real nice here."
She moistened her lips with her arrow-shaped tongue.
"You and I can work together," she said.
"Any way you want it,"
he said ingratiatingly, and a surge of pleasant expectation grew in him. He waited patiently. She took a good long time to begin. At last she said,
"Joe, I don't like to have anything stolen."
"I didn't take nothing."
"I didn't say you did."
"Ooh."
"I'll get to it, Joe. Do you remember that old buzzard we had to move?"
"You mean Ethel, what's her name?"
"Yes, that's the one. She got away with something. I didn't know it then."
"What?"
A coldness crept into her voice.
"Not your business, Joe. Listen to me. You're a smart fellow. Where would you go to look for her?"
Joe's mind worked quickly, not with reason, but with experience and instinct.
"She was pretty beat up. She wouldn't go far. An old hustler don't go far."
"You're smart.
You think she might be in Watsonville?
There, or maybe Santa Cruz. Anyways, I'll give odds she ain't farther away than San Jose.
She caressed her fingers tenderly. Would you like to make 500, Joe?
You want I should find her?
Yes, just find her. When you do, don't let her know. Just bring me the address. Got that? Just tell me where she is.
Okay, said Joe. She must have rolled you good.
That's not your business, Joe.
Yes, ma'am, he said. You want I should start right off?
Yes, make it quick, Joe.
Might be a little tough, he said. It's been a long time.
That's up to you.
I'll go to Watsonville this afternoon.
That's good, Joe. She was thoughtful. He knew she wasn't finished, and that she was wondering whether she should go on. She decided. Joe, did she do anything, well, peculiar that day in court?
Hell no. Said she was framed like they always do.
And then something came back to him that he hadn't noticed at the time. Out of his memory, Ethel's voice came, saying, Judge, I gotta see you alone. I gotta tell you something. He tried to bury his memory deep so that his face wouldn't speak. Kate said, Well, what was it?
He had been too late. His mind leaped for safety. There's something, he said to gain time. I'm trying to think.
Well, think.
Her voice was edged and anxious.
Well, he had it. Well, I heard her tell the cops, see. She said why couldn't they let her go south? Said she had relatives in San Luis Obispo.
Kate leaned quickly toward him. Yes?
And the cops said it was too damn far.
You're smart, Joe. Where will you go first?
Watsonville, he said. I got a friend in San Luis. He'll look around for me. I'll give him a ring.
Joe, she said sharply, I want this quiet.
For 500, you'll get it, quiet and quick, said Joe.
He felt fine, even though her eyes were slitted and inspective again. Her next words jarred his stomach loose from his backbone. Joe, not to change the subject, does the name Venuta mean anything to you?
He tried to answer before his throat tightened.
Not a thing, he said.
Come back as soon as you can, Kate said. Tell Helen to come in. She'll take over for you.
Joe packed his suitcase, went to the depot, and bought a ticket for Watsonville. At Castroville, the first station north, he got off and waited 4 hours for the Del Monte Express from San Francisco to Monterey, which is at the end of a spur line. In Monterey, he climbed the stairs of the Central Hotel, registered as John Vicker. He went downstairs and ate a steak at Pop Ernst's, bought a bottle of whiskey, and retired to his room. He took off his shoes and his coat and vest, removed his collar and tie, and lay down on the bed. The whiskey and a glass were on the table beside the brass bed. The overhead light shining in his face didn't bother him. He didn't notice it. Methodically, he primed his brain with half a tumbler of whiskey, and then he crossed his hands behind his head and crossed his ankles, and he brought out thoughts and impressions and perceptions and instincts and began matching them. It had been a good job, and he had thought he had her fooled. Well, he'd underrated her. But how in hell had she got onto it? He was wanted. He thought he might go to Reno, or maybe to Seattle. Seaport towns, always good. And then, now wait a minute. Think about it. Ethel didn't steal nothing. She had something. Kate was scared of Ethel. 500 was a lot of dough to dig out a beat-up whore. What Ethel wanted to tell the judge was, number one, true, and number two, Kate was scared of it. Might be able to use that.
Hell, not with her holding that jailbreak over him. Joe wasn't going to serve out the limit with penalties. But no harm in thinking about it. Suppose he was to gamble 4 years against, well, let's say 10 grand. Was that a bad bet?
No need to decide. She knew it before and didn't turn him in. Suppose she thought he was a good dog. Maybe Ethel might be a hole card.
Now, wait. Just think about it. Maybe it was the brakes.
Maybe he ought to draw his hand and see.
But she was so goddamn smart. Joe wondered if he could play against her. But how, if he just played along?
Joe sat up and filled his glass full. He turned off his light and raised his shade. And as he drank his whiskey, he watched a skinny little woman in a bathrobe washing her stockings in a basin in a room on the other side of the air shaft. And the whiskey muttered in his ears, "It might be the brakes." God knows Joe had waited long enough. God knows he hated the bitch with her sharp little teeth. No need to decide right now. He raised his window quietly and threw the writing pen from the table against the window across the air shaft. He enjoyed the scene of fear and apprehension before the skinny dame yanked her shade down. With the third glass of whiskey, the pint was empty. Joe felt a wish to go out in the street and look the town over, but then his discipline took over. He had made a rule and kept to it never to leave his room when he was drinking. That way a man never got in trouble. Trouble meant cops, and cops meant a checkup, and that would surely mean a trip across the bay to San Quentin. And no road gang for good behavior this time. He put the street out of his mind. Joe had another pleasure he saved for times when he was alone, and he was not aware it was a pleasure. He indulged it now. He lay on the brass bed and went back in time over his sullen and miserable childhood and his fretful and vicious growing up. No luck. He never got the breaks. The big shots got the breaks. A few snatch jobs he got away with, but the tray of pocket knives? Cops came right in his house and got him. Then he was on the books and they never let him alone. Guy in Daly City couldn't shag a crate of strawberries off a truck without they'd pick up Joe. In school he didn't have no luck neither. Teachers against him, principal against him. Guy couldn't take that crap, had to get out. Out of his memory of bad luck, a warm sadness grew, and he pushed it with more memories until the tears came to his eyes and his lips quivered with pity for the lonely, lost boy he had been. And here he was now, look at him, a rap against him, working in a whorehouse when other men had homes and cars. They were safe and happy, and at night their blinds were pulled down against Joe. He wept quietly until he fell asleep. Joe got up at 10 in the morning and ate a monster breakfast at Pop Ernst's. In the early afternoon, he took a bus to Watsonville and played 3 games of snooker with a friend who came to meet him in answer to a phone call. Joe won the last game and racked his cue. He handed his friend 2 $10 bills. "Hell," said his friend, "I don't want your money." "Take it," said Joe. "It ain't like I give you anything." "You give me plenty. You say she ain't here, and you're the baby that would know." "Can't tell me what you want her for?" "Wilson, I told you right first, and I'll tell you now. I don't know. I'm just doing a job of work." "Well, that's all I can do. Seems like there was this convention. What was it? Dentists, or maybe owls. I don't know whether she said she was going, or I just figured it myself. I got it stuck in my mind. Give Santa Cruz a whirl. Know anybody?"
"I got a few acquaintances," said Joe.
"Look up H.V. Mahler, Hal Mahler. He runs Hal's pool room. Got a game in back."
"Thanks," said Joe.
"No, look, Joe, I don't want your money."
"It ain't my money. Buy a cigar," said Joe.
The bus dropped him 2 doors from Hal's place. It was supper time, but the stud game was still going. It was an hour before Hal got up to go to the can and Joe could follow and make a connection. Hal peered at Joe with large, pale eyes made huge by thick glasses.
He buttoned his fly slowly and adjusted his black alpaca sleeve guards and squared his green eyeshade.
"Stick around till the game breaks," he said. "Care to sit in? How many playing for you, Hal?"
"Only one."
"I'll play for you." $5 an hour, said Hal. "And 10% if I win?" "Well, okay. Sandy-haired fellow Williams is the house."
At 1 o'clock in the morning, Hal and Joe went to Barlow's Grill.
"Two rib steaks and French fries. You want soup?"
Hal asked Joe.
"No, and no French fries. They bind me up."
"Me too," said Hal. "But I eat them just the same. I don't get enough exercise."
Hal was a silent man until he was eating. He rarely spoke unless his mouth was full.
"What's your pitch?" he asked around steak.
"Just a job. I make $100 and you get 25, okay?"
"Gotta have, like, proof? Like papers?"
"No. Be good, but I'll get by without them."
"Well, she come in, wants me to steer for her. She wasn't no good. I didn't take 20 a week off her. I probably wouldn't have knew what become of her, only Bill Primus seen her in my place, and when they found her, he come in and asked me about her. Nice fella, Bill. We got a nice force here."
Ethel wasn't a bad woman. Lazy, sloppy, but good-hearted. She wanted dignity and importance. She just wasn't very bright and not very pretty, and because of these two lacks, not very lucky. It would have bothered Ethel if she had known that when they pulled her out of the sand, where waves had left her half-buried, her skirts were pulled around her ass. She would have liked more dignity.
Hal said, "We got some crazy bohunk bastards in the sardine fleet. Get loaded with ink, and they go nuts. Way I figure, one of them sardine crews took her out and then just pushed her overboard. I don't see how else she'd get in the water.
Maybe she jumped off the pier."
"Her?" said Hal through potatoes. "Hell no. She was too fucking lazy to kill herself." "You want to check?"
"If you say it's her, it's her," said Joe. And he pushed a 20 and a 5 across the table.
Hal rolled the bills like a cigarette and put them in his vest pocket. He cut out the triangle of meat from the rib steak and put it in his mouth.
"It was her," he said. "Want a piece of pie?"
Joe meant to sleep until noon, but he awakened at 7 and lay in bed for quite a long time. He planned not to get back to Salinas until after midnight. He needed more time to think. When he got up, he looked in the mirror and inspected the expression he planned to wear. He wanted to look disappointed, but not too disappointed. Kate was so goddamn clever. Let her lead. Just follow suit. She was about as wide open as a fist. Joe had to admit that he was scared to death of her. His caution said to him, "Just go in and tell her and get your 500. And he answered his caution savagely.
"Breaks! How many breaks did I ever get? Part of the breaks is knowing a break when you get it. Do I want to be a lousy pimp all my life? Just play it close. Let her do the talking. No harm in that. I can always tell her later, like I just found out, if it don't go good. She could have you in a cell block in 6 hours flat. Not if I play 'em close. What I got to lose? What breaks did I ever get?"
Kate was feeling better. The new medicine seemed to be doing her some good. The pain in her hands was abated, and it seemed to her that her fingers were straighter, the knuckles not so swollen. She had had a good night's sleep, the first in a long time, and she felt good, even a little excited. She planned to have a boiled egg for breakfast. She got up and put on a dressing gown and brought a hand mirror back to the bed. Lying high against the pillows, she studied her face. The rest had done wonders. Pain makes you set your jaw, and your eyes grow falsely bright with anxiety, and the muscles over the temples and along the cheeks, even the weak muscles near to the nose, stand out a little. And that is the look of sickness and of resistance to suffering.
The difference in her rested face was amazing. She looked 10 years younger. She opened her lips and looked at her teeth. Time to go for a cleaning. She took care of her teeth. The gold bridge where the molars were gone was the only repair in her mouth. It was remarkable how young she looked, Kate thought. Just one night's sleep and she snapped back. That was another thing that fooled them. They thought she'd be weak and delicate. She smiled to herself. Delicate like a steel trap. But then she always took care of herself. No liquor, no drugs. And recently she had stopped drinking coffee. And it paid off. She had an angelic face. She put the mirror a little higher so that the crepe at her throat didn't reflect. Her thought jumped to that other angelic face so like hers. What was his name? What the hell was his name? Alec? She could see him moving slowly past, his white surplice edged with lace, his sweet chin down, and his hair glowing under the candlelight. He held the oaken staff and its brass cross angled ahead of him. There was something frigidly beautiful about him, something untouched and untouchable. Well, had anything or anybody ever really touched Kate? Really got through and soiled her? Certainly not. Only the hard outside had been brushed by contacts. Inside, she was intact, as clean and bright as this boy Alec. Was that his name? She chuckled. Mother of two sons, and she looked like a child. If anyone had seen her with the blonde one, could they have any doubt? She thought how it would be to stand beside him in a crowd and let people find out for themselves. What would... Aaron, that was the name. What would he do if he knew? His brother knew. That smart little son of a bitch. Wrong word, mustn't call him that. Might be too true. Some people believed it. And not smart bastard either, born in holy wedlock. Kate laughed aloud. She felt good. She was having a good time. The smart one, the dark one, bothered her. He was like Charles. She had respected Charles, and Charles would probably have killed her if he could. Wonderful medicine. It not only stopped the arthritic pain, it gave her back her courage. Pretty soon she could sell out and go to New York as she had always planned. Kate thought of her fear of Ethel. How sick she must have been, the poor dumb old bag. How would it be to murder her with kindness? When Joe found her, how about taking her on to New York? Keep her close. A funny notion came to Kate. That would be a comical murder, and a murder no one under any circumstances could solve or even suspect. Chocolates, boxes of chocolate, bowls of fondant, bacon, crisp bacon, fat, port wine. And then butter, everything soaked in butter and whipped cream. No vegetables, no fruit, and no amusement either. Stay in the house, dear. I trust you. Look after things. You're tired. Go to bed. Let me fill your glass. I got these new sweets for you. Would you like to take the box to bed? Well, if you don't feel good, why don't you take a physic? These cashews are nice, don't you think? The old bitch would blow up and burst in 6 months. Or how about a tapeworm? Did anyone ever use tapeworms? Who was the man who couldn't get water to his mouth in a sieve? Tantalus? Kate's lips were smiling sweetly, and a gaiety was coming over her. Before she went, it might be good to give a party for her sons. Just a simple little party with a circus afterward for her darlings, her jewels. And then she thought of Aaron's beautiful face, so like her own, and a strange pain, a little collapsing pain, arose in her chest. He wasn't smart. He couldn't protect himself. The dark brother might be dangerous. She had felt his quality. Cal had beaten her. Before she went away, she would teach him a lesson. Maybe, why sure, maybe a dose of the clap might set that young man back on his heels. Suddenly she knew that she didn't want Aaron to know about her. Maybe he could come to her in New York. He would think she had always lived in an elegant little house on the East Side. She would take him to the theater,
to the opera, and people would see them together and wonder at their loveliness, and recognize that they were either brother and sister or mother and son. No one could fail to know. They would go together to Ethel's funeral. She would need an oversized coffin and 6 wrestlers to carry it. Kate was so filled with amusement at her thoughts that she didn't hear Joe's knocking on the door. He opened it a crack and looked in, and he saw her gay and smiling face.
"Breakfast," he said, and nudged the door open with the edge of the linen-covered tray. He pushed the door closed with his knee. "Want it there?" he asked, and gestured toward the gray room with his chin.
"No, I'll have it right here. And I want a boiled egg and a piece of cinnamon toast. 4.5 minutes on the egg. Make sure. I don't want it gooey."
"You must feel better, ma'am."
"I do," she said. "That new medicine is wonderful. You look dragged by dogs, Joe. Don't you feel well?"
"I'm all right," he said, and set the tray on the table in front of the big, deep chair. 4.5 minutes?"
"That's right. And if there's a good apple, a crisp apple, bring that, too."
"You ain't ate like this since I knew you," he said. In the kitchen, waiting for the cook to boil the egg, he was apprehensive. Maybe she knew. He'd have to be careful. But hell, she couldn't hate him for something he didn't know. No crime in that. Back in her room, he said, "Don't have no apples." He said this was a good pear.
"I'd like that even better," said Kate. He watched her chip off the egg and dip a spoon into the shell.
"How is it?"
"Perfect," said Kate. "Just perfect."
"You look good," he said.
"I feel good. You look like hell. What's the matter?"
Joe went into it warily. "Ma'am, there ain't nobody needs 500 like I do."
She said playfully, "There isn't anyone who needs..."
"What?"
"Forget it. What are you trying to say? You couldn't find her, is that it? Well, if you did a good job looking, you'll get your 500. Tell me about it." She picked up the salt shaker and scattered a few grains into the open eggshell. Joe put an artificial joy on his face.
"Thanks," he said. "I'm in a spot. I need it. Well, I looked in Pajaro and Watsonville. Got a line on her in Watsonville, but she'd went to Santa Cruz. Got a smell of her there, but she was gone."
Kate tasted the egg and added more salt. "That all?"
"No," said Joe. "I went it blind there. Dropped down to San Luis, and she had been there too, but gone."
"No trace? No idea where she went?"
Joe fiddled with his fingers. His whole pitch, maybe his whole life, depended on his next words, and he was reluctant to say them.
"Come on," she said at last. "You got something. What is it?"
"Well, it ain't much. I don't know what to think of it."
"Don't think. Just tell. I'll think," she said sharply.
"Might not even be true."
"For Christ's sake," she said angrily.
"Well, I talked to the last guy that seen her. A guy named Joe, like me."
"Did you get his grandmother's name?" she asked sarcastically.
"This guy, Joe, says she loaded up on beer one night and said how she's going to come back to Salinas and lay low. Then she dropped out of sight. This guy, Joe, didn't know nothing more."
Kate was startled out of control. Joe read her quick start, the apprehension, and then the almost hopeless fear and weariness. Whatever it was, Joe had something. He had got the breaks at last. She looked up from her lap and her twisted fingers. "We'll forget the old fart," she said. "You'll get your 500, Joe." Joe breathed shallowly, afraid that any sound might drag her out of her self-absorption. She had believed him. More than that, she was believing things he hadn't told her.
He wanted to get out of the room as quickly as possible. He said, "Thank you, ma'am," but very softly, and he moved silently toward the door.
His hand was on the knob when she spoke with elaborate casualness.
Joe, by the way.
Ma'am?
If you should hear anything about her, let me know, will you?
I sure will. Want me to dig into it?
No, don't bother. It isn't that important.
In his room with the door latched, Joe sat down and folded his arms. He smiled to himself, and instantly he began to work out the future course. He decided to let her brood on it till, say, next week. Let her relax, and then bring up Ethel again. He didn't know what his weapon was or how he was going to use it, but he did know that it was very sharp, and he itched to use it. He would have laughed out loud if he had known that Kate had gone to the gray room and locked its door, and that she sat still in the big chair, and her eyes were closed.
Chapter 46.
Sometimes, but not often, a rain comes to the Salinas Valley in November. It is so rare that the Journal or the Index or both carry editorials about it. The hills turn to a soft green overnight, and the air smells good. Rain at this time is not particularly good in an agricultural sense unless it is going to continue, and this is extremely unusual. More commonly, the dryness comes back, and the fuzz of grass withers, or a little frost curls it, and there's that amount of seed wasted. The war years were wet years, and there were many people who blamed the strange, intransigent weather on the firing of the great guns in France. This was seriously considered in articles and in arguments. We didn't have many troops in France that first winter, but we had millions in training, getting ready to go. Painful as the war was, it was exciting, too. The Germans were not stopped. In fact, they had taken the initiative again, driving methodically toward Paris, and God knew when they could be stopped, if they could be stopped at all. General Pershing would save us if we could be saved. His trim, beautifully uniformed, soldierly figure made its appearance in every paper every day. His chin was granite, and there was no wrinkle on his tunic. He was the epitome of a perfect soldier. No one knew what he really thought. We knew we couldn't lose, and yet we seemed to be going about losing. You couldn't buy flour, white flour, anymore, without taking four times the quantity of brown flour. Those who could afford it ate bread and biscuits made with white flour and made mash for the chickens with the brown. In the old Troop C armory, the Home Guard drilled. Men over 50 and not the best soldier material, but they took setting up exercises twice a week, wore Home Guard buttons and overseas caps, snapped orders at one another, and wrangled eternally about who should be officers. William C. Burt died right on the armory floor in the middle of a push-up. His heart couldn't take it. There were Minutemen, too, so-called because they made one-minute speeches in favor of America in moving picture theaters and in churches. They had buttons, too. The women rolled bandages and wore Red Cross uniforms and thought of themselves as angels of mercy. And everybody knitted something for someone. There were wristlets, short tubes of wool to keep the wind from whistling up soldiers' sleeves. And there were knitted helmets with only a hole in front to look out of. These were designed to keep the new tin helmets from freezing to the head. Every bit of really first-grade leather was taken for officers' boots and for Sam Brown belts. These belts were handsome, and only officers could wear them. They consisted of a wide belt and a strap that crossed the chest and passed under the left epaulette. We copied them from the British, and even the British had forgotten their original purpose, which was possibly to support a heavy sword. Swords were not carried except on parade, but an officer would not be caught dead without a Sam Brown belt. A good one cost as much as $25. We learned a lot from the British, and if they hadn't been good fighting men, we wouldn't have taken it. Men began to wear their handkerchiefs in their sleeves, and some foppish lieutenants carried swagger sticks. One thing we resisted for a long time, though, wristwatches were just too silly.
It didn't seem likely that we would ever copy the Limeys in that. We had our internal enemies, too, and we exercised vigilance. San Jose had a spy scare, and Salinas was not likely to be left behind, not the way Salinas was growing. For about 20 years, Mr. Fenchel had done hand tailoring in Salinas. He was short and round, and he had an accent that made you laugh. All day he sat cross-legged on his table in the little shop on Alisal Street, and in the evening he walked home to his small white house far out on Central Avenue. He was forever painting his house and the white picket fence in front of it. Nobody had given his accent a thought until the war came along, but suddenly we knew. It was German. We had our own personal German. It didn't do him any good to bankrupt himself buying war bonds. That was too easy a way to cover up. The Home Guards wouldn't take him in. They didn't want a spy knowing their secret plans for defending Salinas. And who wanted to wear a suit made by an enemy? Mr. Fenchel sat all day on his table, and he didn't have anything to do. So he basted and ripped and sewed and ripped on the same piece of cloth over and over. We used every cruelty we could think of on Mr. Fenchel. He was our German. He passed our house every day, and there had been a time when he spoke to every man and woman and child and dog, and everyone had answered. Now no one spoke to him, and I can see now in my mind his tubby loneliness and his face full of hurt pride. My sister and I did our part with Mr. Fenchel, and it is one of those memories of shame that still makes me break into a sweat and tighten up around the throat. We were standing in our front yard on the lawn one evening, and we saw him coming with little fat steps. His black Homburg was brushed and squarely set on his head. I don't remember that we discussed our plan, but we must have, to have carried it out so well. As he came near, my sister and I moved slowly across the street, side by side. Mr. Fenchel looked up and saw us moving toward him. We stopped in the gutter as he came by. He broke into a smile and said, "Good evening, John. Good evening, Mary." We stood stiffly side by side, and we said in unison, "Hock der Kaiser!" I can see his face now, his startled, innocent blue eyes. He tried to say something, and then he began to cry. Didn't even try to pretend he wasn't. He just stood there sobbing. And you know, Mary and I turned around and walked stiffly across the street and into our front yard. We felt horrible. I still do when I think of it. We were too young to do a good job on Mr. Fenchel. That took strong men, about 30 of them. One Saturday night, they collected in a bar and marched in a column of fours out Central Avenue, saying, "Hup, hup," in unison. They tore down Mr. Fenchel's white picket fence and burned the front out of his house. No Kaiser-loving son of a bitch was going to get away with it with us. And then Salinas could hold up its head with San Jose. Of course, that made Watsonville get busy. They tarred and feathered a Pole they thought was a German. He had an accent. We of Salinas did all of the things that are inevitably done in a war, and we thought the inevitable thoughts. We screamed over good rumors and died of panic at bad news. Everybody had a secret that he had to spread obliquely to keep its identity as a secret. Our pattern of life changed in the usual manner. Wages and prices went up. A whisper of shortage caused us to buy and store food. Nice, quiet ladies clawed one another over a can of tomatoes. It wasn't all bad or cheap or hysterical. There was heroism, too. Some men who could have avoided the army enlisted, and others objected to the war on moral or religious grounds and took the walk up Golgotha, which normally comes with that. There were people who gave everything they had to the war because it was the last war, and by winning it, we would remove war like a thorn from the flesh of the world, and there wouldn't be any more such horrible nonsense.
There is no dignity in death in battle. Mostly, there is a splashing about of human meat and fluid, and the result is filthy. But there is a great and almost sweet dignity in the sorrow, the helpless, the hopeless sorrow that comes down over a family with the telegram. Nothing to say, nothing to do, and only one hope. I hope he didn't suffer. And what a forlorn and last choice hope that is. And it's true that there were some people who, when their sorrow was beginning to lose its savor, gently edged it toward pride and felt increasingly important because of their loss. Some of these even made a good thing of it after the war was over. That is only natural. Just as it is natural for a man whose life function is the making of money to make money out of a war. No one blamed a man for that, but it was expected that he should invest a part of his loot in war bonds. We thought we invented all of it in Salinas, even the sorrow.
Chapter 47. In the Trask house next to Renault's bakery, Lee and Adam put up a map of the Western Front with lines of colored pins snaking down, and this gave them a feeling of participation. Then Mr. Kelly died, and Adam Trask was appointed to take his place on the draft board. He was the logical man for the job. The ice plant didn't take up much of his time, and he had a clear service record and an honorable discharge himself. Adam Trask had seen a war, a little war of maneuver and butchery, but at least he had experienced the reversal of the rules, where a man is permitted to kill all the humans he can. Adam didn't remember his war very well. Certain sharp pictures stood out in his memory. A man's face, the piled and burning bodies, the clang of saber scabbards at fast trot, the uneven tearing sound of firing carbines, the thin, cold voice of a bugle in the night. But Adam's pictures were frozen. There was no motion or emotion in them. Illustrations in the pages of a book, and not very well drawn. Adam worked hard and honestly and sadly. He couldn't get over the feeling that the young men he passed to the army were under a sentence of death. And because he knew he was weak, he grew more and more stern and painstaking, and much less likely to accept an excuse or a borderline disability. He took the lists home with him, called on parents, in fact, did much more work than was expected of him. He felt like a hanging judge who hates the gallows. Henry Stanton watched Adam grow more gaunt and more silent, and Henry was a man who liked fun, needed it. A sourpussed associate could make him sick. "Relax," he told Adam. "You're trying to carry the weight of the war. Now look, it's not your responsibility. You got put in here with a set of rules. Just follow the rules and relax. You aren't running the war." Adam moved the slats of the blind so that the late afternoon sun wouldn't shine in his eyes, and he gazed down at the harsh parallel lines the sun threw on his desk.
"I know," he said wearily. "Oh, I know that. But, Henry, it's when there's a choice, and it's my own judgment of the merits, that's when it gets me. I passed Judge Kendall's boy, and he was killed in training."
"It's not your business, Adam. Why don't you take a few drinks at night? Go to a movie. Sleep on it."
Henry put his thumbs in the armholes of his vest and leaned back in his chair.
"While we're talking about it, Adam, it seems to me it don't do a candidate a damn bit of good for you to worry. You pass boys, I could be talked into letting off."
"I know," said Adam. "I wonder how long it'll last."
Henry inspected him shrewdly and took a pencil from his stuffed vest pocket and rubbed the eraser against his big white front teeth.
"I see what you mean," he said softly.
Adam looked at him, startled.
"What do I mean?" he demanded.
"Now, don't get huffy. I never thought I was lucky before, just having girls."
Adam traced one of the slat shadows on his desk with his forefinger.
Yes, he said, in a voice as soft as a sigh. It's a long time before your boys will be called up.
Yes.
Adam's finger entered a line of light and slid slowly back. Henry said, I'd hate to...
Hate to what?
I was just wondering how I'd feel if I had to pass on my own sons.
I'd resign, said Adam.
Yes, I can see that. A man'd be tempted to reject them. I mean, his own.
No, said Adam. I'd resign because I couldn't reject them. A man couldn't let his own go free.
Henry laced his fingers and made one big fist of his two hands and laid the fist on the desk in front of him. His face was querulous.
No, he said, you're right, a man couldn't.
Henry liked fun and avoided when he could any solemn or serious matter, for he confused these with sorrow.
How's Aaron doing at Stanford?
Fine. He writes that it's hard, but he thinks he'll make out all right. He'll be home for Thanksgiving.
I'd like to see him. I saw Cal on the street last night. Now, there's a smart boy.
Cal didn't take college tests a year ahead, said Adam.
Well, maybe that's not what he's cut out for. I didn't go to college. Did you?
No, said Adam. I went into the Army.
Well, it's a good experience. I bet you wouldn't take a good bit for the experience.
Adam stood up slowly and picked his hat from the deer horns on the wall.
Good night, Henry, he said.
Walking home, Adam pondered his responsibility. As he passed Renault's bakery, Lee came out, carrying a golden loaf of French bread.
I have a hunger for some garlic bread, Lee said.
I like it with steak, said Adam.
We're having steak.
Was there any mail?
I forgot to look in the box.
They entered the house and Lee went to the kitchen. In a moment, Adam followed him and sat at the kitchen table.
Lee, he said, suppose we send a boy to the Army and he is killed. Are we responsible?
Go on, said Lee. I'd rather have the whole thing at once.
Well, suppose there's a slight doubt that the boy should be in the Army, and we send him, and he gets killed.
I see.
Is it responsibility or blame that bothers you?
I don't want blame.
Sometimes responsibility is worse. It doesn't carry any pleasant egotism.
I was thinking about that time when Sam Hamilton and you and I had a long discussion about a word, said Adam.
What was that word?
Now I see. The word was Timshel.
Timshel. And you said...
I said that the word carried a man's greatness if he wanted to take advantage of it.
I remember Sam Hamilton felt good about it.
It set him free, said Lee. It gave him the right to be a man, separate from every other man.
That's lonely.
All great and precious things are lonely.
What's the word again?
Timshel, thou mayest.
Adam looked forward to Thanksgiving when Aaron would come home from college. Even though Aaron had been away such a short time, Adam had forgotten him and changed him the way any man changes someone he loves. With Aaron gone, the silences were the result of his going, and every little painful event was somehow tied to his absence. Adam found himself talking and boasting about his son, telling people who weren't very interested how smart Aaron was and how he had jumped a year in school. He thought it would be a good thing to have a real celebration at Thanksgiving, to let the boy know his effort was appreciated. Aaron lived in a furnished room in Palo Alto, and he walked the mile to and from the campus every day. He was miserable. What he had expected to find at the university had been vague and beautiful. His picture, never really inspected, had been of clean-eyed young men and immaculate girls, all in academic robes and converging on a white temple on the crown of a wooded hill in the evening. Their faces were shining and dedicated, and their voices rose in chorus, and it was never any time but evening. He had no idea where he had got this picture of